From the beginning of the escalation, as fast as we dispatched new units, the NVA matched them. The enemy, too, upping the ante, confident that we could be tapped out. Westy authorized huge search-and-destroy operations, but whatever return they brought was temporary at best. The enemy just went to ground and waited until the coast was clear to return and rebuild. In every action Slam and I examined, save the first of the 101's Geronimo 1 and the activities of Colonel John Hayes' Special Forces Delta Force, the last unit we visited, which pound for pound and weighed against its cost was the most effective fighting force in Vietnam, U.S. forces had come out badly bloodied. Project Delta, Delta Force, was infinitely successful with its tactics, doctrine, and a basic philosophy completely at odds with the Army's regular units. The same success was not to be found in the other more traditional half of the 5th Special Forces operations, the SFCIDG border camps like To Morong and Doc To. The border camp program still looked good on MACV's big picture operations map, but in fact had long outlived its usefulness as a means to interdict replacement troops and equipment streaming down from the north. At this time in the war, the camps were ineffective, enemy-battered defensive concerns that served as little more than bait for the NVA and VC to lure reinforcing or relieving units into large-scale ambushes. While one would have thought something would be done to change the mission, configuration, or tactics of the border camps to have them again contribute positively to the war effort, no alterations to that end were made, and the border camps seemed set to remain what they'd been too long already, just a very expensive drain on manpower and materiel. Our casualty figures for 1966 equaled those for the Battle of the Bulge more than 20 years before, and though it was true that it took troops in Vietnam 12 months to chalk up figures while it took less than 2 at the Bulge, at least with the Bulge one could say the bitter fighting there virtually ended World War II in Europe. But what greater good had our 1966 casualties in Vietnam achieved? An end to the war was nowhere in sight. The emphasis on body count, a system already as obsolete as the CIDG border camps, was also taking its toll on the war effort by making everyone a bounty hunter and a liar. This yardstick of enemy dead had proved very effective during the British counterinsurgency experiences in Palestine and Malaya. Indeed, according to John Essex Clark, it was the only real measure of success in Malaya, where a platoon could patrol for a year and not see a single guerrilla. But in Vietnam, as the war escalated on both sides and main force and regular VC and NVA units expanded the conflict out of the guerrilla realm of bandidos chasing and being chased through the bush, body count completely outlived its usefulness as a reliable measure of anything. Yet with the passage of time, the reliance on it among the top brass of the military, the Defense Department bureaucrats, and the politicians would only increase. The more bodies we counted, went the thinking, the better we were doing. In fact, my experience with SLAM revealed that the pressure for a high and instant body count interrupted the flow of battle, tied up communications, and created unnecessary casualties among troopers tasked with the job of doing the counting during a fight. Body count was also well on its way to destroying whatever was left of the moral code of soldiers and officers in the zero-defect army. Leaders did not challenge suspect figures reported by subordinate units, who themselves knew the importance of a significant count, and too often actively inflated their scores to please their ER raiders or just to get higher HQ off their backs. Sometimes a body count was completely made up to mask a screwed-up mission. In just one instance, a battalion commander asked one of his company COs over the radio to tell him his college football jersey number to have something to report for a botched operation. 86, said the company commander. 86, exclaimed the battalion commander. Great body count. Body count was much in the tradition of the Korean certificate of loss, in that it assuaged sectors of the public and the government that might otherwise have grown indignant over the waste the war was responsible for. But body count was infinitely more dangerous because, like Paul Revere IV and other such essentially bogus after-action reports, the inflated counts made it all the way up the chain of command, where they became the proof-positive statistic that we were winning. Hank Emerson had suggested that rather than a body count, a weapons count should have been employed in Vietnam, as such a statistic would be very difficult to fudge on the battlefield. The colonels and generals Slam and I met on our trip were, in the main, very much entrenched in the can-do, at-all-costs bureaucracy that fostered inflated body counts and the like. As such, they seemed truly blind to the crucial shortcomings in the war effort. It was a bad situation only exacerbated by the obscene luxury available to many at base camps like the 1st Air Cavs and the 1st Divisions. Vietnam was as complicated a conflict as the U.S. had ever known, yet the longer many of these generals stayed, the less they understood the war or even tried to. So caught up were they with the finer things in life available in a war zone. I found it interesting that these guys, many of whom had learned little in their last combat commands in the Sitzkrieg days of the Korean War, still managed to take the worst lessons Korea offered and make them the standard for Vietnam. Of course, as a European-style war superimposed on an Asian mainland, the Korean conflict was an extremely poor training ground for a new kind of warfare, even if the generals had taken the time to try to learn from it, which the vast majority did not. It is also worth noting that in Korea, while the warriors commanded the first year's bitter fighting, the Army's legion of clerks, dancers, and prancers only volunteered their services to the effort after the war settled down, when it was much harder to screw up or get hurt, and there was plenty of time for empire building. Our rifle units, which were turning over every 90 days, were ragtag and shamefully inefficient. Young draftees were running squads. Company commanders were kids with an average of 3 years commissioned service, an experience level shockingly low to do battle with an enemy who'd been fighting all his life. Old NCOs were few and far between, the NCO Corps well on the road to being totally gutted through death and injury, or because the old non-coms simply saw the writing on the wall. Many, many good NCOs were quitting after a single tour rather than find themselves being sent back again and again for another Korea, another war there seemed no intention of winning. Without the NCOs, there was no muscle within the units, and with the constant rotation of company and battalion commanders, that is, the moment they stopped looking green, there was no institutional memory either, to prevent repeated mistakes and to make things happen. The companies themselves were paper thin. Almost all of the 100 we came across in our travels were operating at around 50% of their authorized strength. At about 115 men, that was barely more than two platoons. So where were the rest? R&R, or sick, or lost in the logistics and support maze emanating from the base camps. At any rate, only a fraction of our army in the theater was out beating the bush. The tooth-to-tail ratio of fighters to supporters was thought to be as low as 1 to 10, with the preponderance of the supporters working at the huge administration setups at Long Binh, Nha Trang, and the Saigon area as typists, truck drivers, and the like. It made no sense to me. In the peacetime army, if a CO fell out with only 50% of his men for an ATT or an ORT, or even for everyday training, he'd be relieved. In the peacetime army, a CO had to account for the whereabouts of every single trooper in his command. Yet here in Vietnam, in combat, I never heard one senior officer complain, much less worry about this problem. It was hard to believe they didn't notice. After all, it was not unlike driving a car on two tires. Nor did anyone seem to notice the pungent smell of marijuana that now permeated many a base camp. It was sold everywhere, for a nickel a joint, or in a pack of 20 disguised as a sealed box of Marlboros. With three-quarters of the soldiers in Vietnam now draftees, regular army booze was taking a back seat to the weed, and though I didn't see it this tour, it was more than obvious that it was just a matter of time before marijuana made its way from the rear areas to the fighting line. MacV denied there was a problem and stuck their heads in the sand. In 1968, when heroin found its way into those Buddha grass Marlboro joints, eventually turning some 20 to 30% of the U.S. military in Vietnam into junkies before you could say, "Far out, man," it would be too late to turn the tide. "Hack, all armies are inefficient," Slam counseled whenever I tried to share with him the litany of formidable foes our tour had uncovered for me. Why, at best, they operate at 20%. Right now, the VC are limping along at 6%, so no matter how screwed up Westy's army is, it's twice as well off, if not more, than the enemy. Concentrate on tactics, Hack. That's your forte. I don't give these communists more than a year. Surprised they've held on this long. Slam's regularly offered prognosis on the war almost invariably led to an argument between us on the subject of firepower versus the will of the people and guerrilla versus conventional war. At first, I'd thought I'd win such a debate hands down. Slam knew next to nothing of the history of the Vietnam conflict, having never read Bernard Fall or General Jopp or even Jules Roy's recently translated The Battle of Dien Bien Phu. But even when I could prove that the operations he and I had examined were chillingly similar to those of the French, change the name from Paul Revere IV to Operation Lorraine, replace helicopter cav squadrons with mobile groups and all the way, sir, with Bien Mon Commandant, and no one could tell the difference except that the Americans were losing on an infinitely larger scale. Slam's routine and obstinate response was that war was war, and I didn't understand it. Okay, I said to myself in early discussions on the subject. Unlike Slam, I had not participated in or written about two world wars and two land wars in Asia, which was one of Marshall's most compelling and frequently voiced claims to credibility. And Slam was right. There was no question that the pounding our forces were administering was, day by day, sapping the enemy's strength. But one thing I knew was soldiers, and while I, too, could see the enemy getting physically weaker, I also saw his will growing stronger. Throughout the trip on those days Slam holed up in his VIP quarters to bang out his newspaper column, Dateline, somewhere in the Central Highlands, or flew to Saigon to do his television and radio tapings, I tried to go to the POW compounds and talk to some of the prisoners. I always told them I was just a historian trying to understand how both sides waged the war, and when they realized I didn't care what unit they were from and I wasn't there to get any secrets, from commanders to the lowest ranks, they became openly friendly and helpful. I learned plenty. And by the time the tour with Slam was over, I had a damn good idea of what our North Vietnamese and VC enemy did and how he thought, both on the battlefield and off. I came away convinced that though our opponent wasn't invincible, his ability to endure was. He had the will. He had the numbers. The Eastern Bloc kept him moderately well supplied. To date, he controlled the hearts and minds of the people, and he knew he had time on his side. It had taken him 1,000 years to kick out the Chinese, and less than 100 to get rid of the French. What did it matter how long for the Americans, who actually made things easier by repeating the mistakes of the French? When I asked how long they were prepared to fight, almost every prisoner, from the uneducated simple farm boys to the better-versed officers, said 10 to 15 to 20 years. They were going to win, they said, and they were prepared to stay in South Vietnam as long as necessary to do so. Are you? One asked. I told Slam all this, and point for point invariably won every debate we had, or would have won had Slam not always launched into his war is war discussion ender. Strangely enough, I had a gnawing feeling he actually agreed with me much of the time, that he was aware as I that we were sinking deeper and deeper into a quagmire, but he refused to add up the facts, or at the very least, wouldn't let the facts get in the way of his prejudgment of the situation. Meanwhile, body bags were filling with American youths at a rate of 200 to 400 a week, and through it all there were the infantry troopers who clung to the belief that somehow in all this madness, someone, somewhere, had to know what he was doing. After Project Delta, we packed our bags for Saigon for the last time. Slam insisted we stay at the Oriental Hotel, a sleazy flop house in the fish stall area of the city where no Westerner in his right mind stayed. The place was located in a narrow alleyway not even wide enough for a jeep. Our cramped, stifling room, awash with Saigon's big city sewer smell, the result of long-time uncollected garbage left to ripen in an unrelenting sun, was on street level, The Viets were always crowding around the window, peering in at Slam's fatigue cap, which he had the habit of posing in plain view when not in use. I'd shudder every time someone pointed at the huge star and joined in the chorus of, "Dai Tuong, Dai Tuong, General, General." Half the onlookers were VC, and a general, even a private citizen pretend general like Slam, would be a great prize. I took to throwing a towel over the fatigue cap, wearing civilian gear and spending every spare moment with John Westmoreland at his house or at the New York bar. The few nights I had to stay at the Oriental, I slept with one eye open and a pistol at the ready. Meanwhile, the Tet of 67 celebrations had begun, ushering out the year of the horse and ushering in the year of the goat. A year later, it would come as little surprise to me how easily the Viet Cong's Tet offensive got underway. As Slam and I walked through the city one afternoon, dodging huge, uncontrollable crowds and frequently screaming at each other to be heard over the din of wall-to-wall exploding firecrackers, we even talked about how simple it would be for the VC to use the noise and confusion of Tet to launch a great attack. "They're bound to use this cover sometime," Slam remarked. I agreed, and I hoped it wouldn't be that evening as I asked permission to spend another night at Westy's. It was just madness to stay in the back streets of Saigon, especially at that time. By regulation, as a civilian, Slam couldn't stay in MacV quarters, but there were two lovely, secure hotels to choose from in the city, the Caravel and the Continental Palace, though Sam would later write that we stayed at the Native Oriental because we liked the people. The real reason was a bit less convivial. Slam was incredibly cheap when the army was not picking up the tab, and besides, the high-priced Caravel and Continental were off-limits because, as Slam would say derisively, that's where the press stays. Slam hated the press, of which he did not feel a part, despite the fact that he made most of his money the same way they did. With few exceptions, he thought they were freeloaders on the system, spending their time in Vietnam doing virtually everything but covering battles in the field. It galled him that the slant of many of the young journalists' work appeared anti-war, leading him to brand such men as David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan commies and truly believe they were, or dealt with the politics rather than the strictly military aspects of the conflict. He simply could not see that each was inextricably intertwined with the other, any more than he saw any incongruity between his public disparagement of so many of his fellow media men and women as cowards and cynics and his own privileged position as guru to the generals. I could no more have imagined, for example, Slam Marshall on the ground in a firefight as any number of the other journalists were on a regular basis than I could any of those other journalists standing in a general's mess saying, as Slam would and often did in an offhand cheerful way, "I always think better with a bourbon at hand," and a horse handler immediately being dispatched to fill his glass and charge his battery. The night after our obligatory exit briefing with the USRV staff, Slam and I stayed at the Oriental Hotel and roared through some bourbon ourselves. The briefing had gone well for Slam, but not so well for me. My view that we desperately, immediately needed to find a new strategy for the war because we were losing and losing fast was not well received. Fortunately, Slam was there to lift the spirits of the entire top brass audience with his opposing, "We got him on the ropes" assessment. This view was accepted unquestionably for the reason, I could only guess, that most of these guys didn't have a clue as to what the war was all about in the first place, so were more than happy to shuffle their staff papers, endorse exaggerated after-action reports, and accept good General Marshall's assessment that it was going just fine. Mercifully, I was not invited to Slam's exit dinner with General Westmoreland. The following evening, however, as the bourbon took hold, I took the mellow opportunity to try to tell Slam for the millionth time that the summing up he invariably gave to the top brass bore no relation to the facts we'd gleaned over the last few months, and he knew it. But Slam was unconcerned and flying high. As the evening continued and the bottle emptied, he just became more and more expansive, talking about the success of our trip as if we'd just made a major contribution to winning the war. "A million words, Hack," he exclaimed, patting the stack of notebooks at his side, which he never let out of his sight, in which were recorded all the after-action interviews from all the schools. and every one of them is gold. I got 8 solid books here," he continued. "How's that for an insurance policy for Kate and the kids?" Kate was Slam's wife, and he often said the power behind him. She was much younger than her husband, and Slam was always very concerned about providing for her beyond the grave. "I'll write them in advance," he said now, "and she can publish them one at a time when I'm gone." Personally, at that point, my thoughts were of the thousands of young infantrymen who would be gone long before Slam if somebody didn't pick up the overall game in the ground war. I'd kept my own notebook during the trip, in which I'd kept an ongoing list of my observations of our Army's repeated tactical failings, as well as the details of my discussions with over 100 POWs. I felt there was a book there, too, a handy-dandy little guide of do's and don'ts on how to fight the bad guys that could be a significant contribution to the fighting men. But Slam didn't want to do it. His eyes flashed dollar signs only when he talked of his own 8 potential pork chop hills, and considering that the Army had thousands of manuals and dozens of schools, it really was crazy that a book such as I was proposing was needed. But in my view, it was urgent, and I badgered Slam nonstop until he'd changed his mind. I started to write the minute he gave me his half-hearted okay, but pretty quickly he too got into the spirit of it, and before we left Vietnam, the first draft of the Vietnam Primer was done. The night before we headed home, the general and I went to the Rex Hotel for dinner. We sat under the stars at the rooftop bistro, perfectly situated to drink, eat, and watch the war. Artillery was popping in what was left of the jungles around Saigon. Operation Cedar Falls, which had replaced Attleboro as the largest operation of the war so far, was just winding up its Sisyphean mission of destroying the Iron Triangle and all other VC redoubts in the area. The Iron Triangle would prove no more after Cedar Falls than it had been when Butch Williamson proclaimed it so more than a year before. What had once consisted of 50 square kilometers of the unknown, he'd said back then, has now been destroyed. One more enemy bulwark, psychological and physical, has been completely marked off the situation map. As I watched Puff the Magic Dragon lighting the sky with flares and whining over distant contact areas, I thought of the Saigon cowboy Pat Graves met here once on leave from his first of the 327th platoon. Saigon cowboys were a breed of rear echelon soldiers, so called for their latest and greatest dressed to the hilt warrior look that they took no closer to the combat zone than absolutely necessary. One of these guys sat down with Graves and fellow platoon leader Chuck Oliphant, and after a time reverently drew their attention to the brightness of the flares in the Saigon night sky. The above-the-rest boys looked at each other and then at himself in disbelief. The flares, under observation, were in fact neon lights on the building across the street. Just then, the Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office, JUSPAO Lieutenant Commander, who'd been assigned to Slam's Saigon contact, approached our table. With him was a VIP he wanted the general to meet. It was Bernard Fall, the greatest writer on the Indochina War and, through his books, one of my greatest teachers. A native of France, Fall had lived the history of his country's Indochina conflict, a history many Americans, including Slam Marshall, chose to ignore. Unlike Slam, who flew from CP to CP in his own personal chopper, ate off China plates, and gathered his information and gained his expertise second and third hand at secured base camps after the firing was over, ever since 1953, Fall had strapped on his pack, carried his rations, and tagged along with combat soldiers on both sides of the conflict to understand the war. He had also spoken with many top leaders on both sides, including Jop and Ho. Himself a guerrilla with the French underground, at the age of 16, Fall knew insurgent and counterinsurgent warfare inside out. Yet his views that the Americans were going about the problem much as the French had, which was to say, all wrong, were wholly unwelcome to the Johnson administration, and it would seem to the top Pentagon brass as well. Fall believed that, like the French, we could not win the war. "Oh, we could win it militarily," he said when he'd sat down at Slam's and my table for an exchange of ideas, "and we would win it that way, Like Slam, Fall was convinced that our enormous firepower and stunning mobility, two things the French didn't have, would prove decisive. According to Fall, less bomb power was brought to bear in the 56-day Battle of Dien Bien Phu than in any single day during the present U.S. involvement. One U.S. mission, he said, employed more aircraft than the French had possessed in all of Indochina throughout their entire involvement there. But, he continued, a military victory was somewhat irrelevant because Vietnam was first and foremost a political war which the Americans, just like the French, did not understand. The Americans would never win the war politically, so they would never win the war. Marshall's position was his usual war is war, and we were winning this one. I don't know anything about the politics, he said. All he knew was Vietnam was just a war. In the short term, we would save the Vietnamese from the communists, and in so doing would, in the long term, stop worldwide communist aggression. In the course of the evening, Fall gave Slam a quiet education on the Vietnamese, their culture, their history, their unflagging determination since before the Common Era to rid their country of outside invaders. Bombing the enemy back to the Stone Age, he said, was not the answer to the problem the communists represented. Social reform was. Offer the Vietnamese a better life and watch them come over to our side. Late in the night, Slam went back to the Oriental to sack out. I'd said very little throughout the evening, but now Fall and I talked for another hour or so. He told me he was going up to I Corps next, to join the U.S. Marines who were operating on the street without joy. Can I tell you something? I said. I've been an infantryman most of my life, and one thing I know is you can only go tagging along with squads for so long before you get killed. It's like rolling the dice, Bernard, I continued, and was stunned to hear myself almost pleading. You can make so many passes, but eventually you've got to crap out. You'll buy the farm if you keep going out on patrols. You're going to have to find another way to look at the war. You tell me how one can understand the war without dealing with the people, Fall challenged me, without seeing how they are fighting, without seeing the results. He was right, of course. There was no other way. 2 weeks later, Bernard Fall was walking along the street he'd made famous, the street without joy, with a U.S. Marine Corps patrol. He was talking into his tape recorder, reporting the war. Shadows are lengthening, and we've reached one of our phase lines after the firefight, he was saying, and it smells bad, meaning it's a little suspicious. Could be an ambush. Fall's monologue was interrupted by an exploding booby trap, and in that instant, he was dead. Bernard Fall's death at the age of 40 was undoubtedly one of the great tragedies of the tragic war in Vietnam. Although persona non grata among the military and top Washington political men who were actually running the war, those, that is, who turned to Slam Marshall for the good news, at the time of his death, Fall had a large and growing following. Through his books, he was awakening people all across America, not only members of the intellectual community, but many a perceptive soul in the military and the defense and state departments as well. Perhaps, had he lived, he could have made a significant impression on the Nixon administration. If only he could have convinced Marshall, I thought many times. Slam had the audience. Slam had Westies and the president's ears. It didn't matter that he would have been out of his depth talking strategy. I'd come to realize Slam was out of his depth on most subjects, but he was a great Sammy Glick of all things military and everyone still listened to him. But Slam was not convinced. He couldn't be. The war itself was his insurance policy for Kate and his kids. To tell the president, the military, and the American people that it had to stop would have been biting the hand that fed him. And it was not something Slam was about to do. So our boys went on fighting. Slam went on writing, and one by one the predictions of Bernard Fall, based not on some superhuman prescience, but on being there, studying, and caring, became realities. And when the observations he made and desperately tried to convey from 1953 onward became impossible for the American powers that be to ignore, and much later, when the war was long over, it was Fall's widow, Dorothy, who would time and again receive the shame-faced apologies of men who'd refused to listen. Slam paid his hotel bill in green American dollars and got a good rate. This practice was forbidden by MACV currency regulations, but anyone who'd been in Vietnam long, or for that matter, in almost any inflation-ridden country, did it. I learned this trick in Spain when I was covering the Civil War, Slam said unabashedly of his exchange as he pocketed his wallet and we headed for Tonsonet Airport and home. We stopped in Hawaii, where we were debriefed by the U.S. Army Pacific USARPAC staff. After the USARV briefing, I'd narrowed my wide-ranging concerns to three suggestions for improving our combat efficiency in the war. Though I doubted I could make an impact, I shared them with these USARPAC people now. That a unit replacement rotation policy be instituted rather than the current individual one. That the one-year rotation policy apply to combat troops only, while the clerks and officers of the rank of major and above would have a two-year tour and only receive combat pay if they earned it, and, most important, that a training school specifically for battalion commanders be formed pronto to get these critical leaders read into the nature of the war and the proven U.S. and enemy tactics. Unfortunately, as had been the case at USARV, my views were shrugged off as alarmist by these guys who were even more out of touch with the war than the boys in Saigon, and Slam did nothing to change their minds. For me, the weather improved considerably when we got back to Washington. General Johnson not only approved of our idea for the Vietnam primer and extended my TDY with Slam for another month so we could finish writing it, but he also took a very personal interest in the project. The liaison on this book is between you and me, Hackworth, so come up any time. The two of us went over the manuscript together, word for word, in the next weeks, and although the final product bore the disclaimer that Slam's and my opinions did not necessarily reflect official DA positions, I really felt Harold K. Johnson did agree on almost every point therein. The only areas he really objected to in the original draft were our harsh discussions of the M16 and of body count. In both cases, Johnson felt we got carried away, that the M16 was an emotional issue with me, which it was, and the results of our interviews in Vietnam had only reinforced my hatred of the weapon, and that body count was too sensitive an issue in itself to be the subject of my literary wrath. He personally rewrote part of the M16 section, and though he kind of took the teeth out of the body count discussion, he didn't change the intent. But most importantly, the chief of staff pushed the Vietnam primer from the word go. The book was basically a lessons learned, covering the areas of our own and the enemy's security, communications, movement, weapons, intelligence, and training, as well as a substantial chapter devoted to enemy ruses, decoys, and ambushes. Johnson himself wrote the foreword, and the book's publication became a top priority. When I took it to the adjutant general with the simple, "General Johnson asked me to come by and get this printed right away," almost before I knew it, there were a million copies being distributed all around the world. Meanwhile, Slam insisted the primer, which was also produced in Thai, Viet, and Korean, be classified for official use only, which prompted another mini-battle between us. "If we classify it, then soldiers won't be able to carry it into battle," I said. "Don't worry, Hack. It'll get around." "But what's there to classify in there? There is nothing secret in the whole damn thing. It's enemy tactics. Don't you think the enemy knows what their tactics are?" "Hack," Slam replied patiently, "the reason I want it classified is so it will not be in the public domain. That way, later on, you and I can rewrite it and publish it commercially." For Slam, it was just another way to make a buck. Slam Marshall would remain an enigma to me throughout our relationship and for many years beyond. He was a mean, power-wrapped little man who threw his weight around shamelessly. How often I saw him in Vietnam offhandedly promising hungry and raptured colonels and generals alike a mention in the Daily Dispatch, Slam's syndicated column, or in his next conversation with Johnny or Westy, but who also had the capacity to be sincere and generous and kind. He once told me the secret of his success was his philosophy of doing one thing well. "Long ago, I decided to specialize in the infantry squad and platoon in battle," he said. "So while most of the other fellows were spreading themselves too thin grappling with the big picture, I became the Army's expert." Yet he had long since abandoned that tack, and instead had actually come to believe he knew almost everything about everything. And incredibly, he was able to convince a lot of people who counted that he really did. On the other hand, there were those like Captain Eggleston, my trust company commander, now a lieutenant colonel, whose one and only encounter with Marshall at a lecture at Fort Benning had immediately conjured up for him one of his father's old sayings. If you could buy him for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth, you could retire. Marshall could be a braggart of the first order. I could write on toilet paper with a crayon and sell it, was a routine boast. But his favorite claim to fame was at first the most puzzling to me, and years later, the most significant in terms of unraveling the hustler and the phony that he was, and how he was nonetheless able to make such a mark on the U.S. Army. Slam regularly brought up the fact that the Army had made him a general despite his never having attended even one military school, and that he was the only general in the Army to have this distinction. He neglected to say, and never would have had I not followed it up out of sheer curiosity, that he'd gotten his star not in the regular Army, but in the reserve. Meanwhile, with no reason not to believe him, I accepted Slam's stories of World War I, his experiences as an infantryman in all the major campaigns, his battlefield commission to become the youngest second lieutenant in the U.S. Army during the war, the romantic tale he spun of Armistice Day, when he saw in the end of the war sharing his canteen with his brigade commander in the trenches. With no reason not to believe him, I accepted Slam's tales of World War II, too. His participation in the fighting in the Pacific, as well as his service in Europe, which had him in the front line of the Normandy invasion. It would be many, many years, years in which Slam repeated the stories endlessly, in which his reputation was only further bolstered as one or the other appeared in everything from Current Biography, 1953, to the obituaries upon his death in 1977, and in his autobiography published 2 years later, before I would discover that it was all a lie. Slam had been an enlisted man with the 315th Engineers, 90th Infantry Division, during World War I, and spent his time not fighting as an infantryman, but repairing French roads until just before the war's end. He had not been battlefield commissioned, and he wasn't anywhere near the trenches on 11 November 1918, being instead at the Army's France-based Officer Candidate School, then called the Infantry Candidate School. The proclaimed youngest lieutenant in World War I, who in fact never served as an officer in a TOE outfit, reserve or regular, in any capacity, ever, was not commissioned until April 1919, long after the last angry shots were fired. According to his service record, Slam saw no infantry combat in World War II either, though he was awarded the CIB for the Marshall Islands campaign while serving on the DA staff, and far from being on the ground from the earliest hours of the 6 June 1944 Normandy invasion, Slam didn't even arrive in the European theater until July, and then it was as a staff officer historian reconstructing the operation. And while Slam would speak with pride of being the only American soldier to serve in all four of America's great wars in the 20th century, it was a claim more than a little deceptive. His Korean War experience covered exactly 3 months, December 50 through February 51, when he was recalled from the reserves to active duty as a historian operations analyst for the 8th Army, a stint for his country that produced the River and the Gauntlet for himself, and his service in Vietnam was undertaken as a 6-year retired reserve general and a 40-year experienced journalist, Slam's job when he wasn't wearing khaki, looking for a story on the Army's tab. A historian as careless with his own history as Slam Marshall was could hardly be a careful historian, and Marshall proved the rule. Veterans of many of the actions he documented in his books have complained bitterly over the years of his inaccuracy or blatant bias. For the lay audience, however, his gift was that what he lacked in accuracy in his books with regard to names of people, places, and units, not to mention events, he made up for by the immediacy he brought to the stories. He always wrote as if he were on the scene, jumping out of the plane, storming the beach, assaulting the hill. It was a conscious effort on his part to give the audience the impression he was there, Sometimes he wrote that he actually was there, conferring with and giving advice to the generals, or virtually sharing a foxhole with the troops. He didn't seem to care that what he wrote was totally inaccurate and easily disproved. He seemed to have relied, and successfully so, on the notion that no one would ever dare to correct him, to say, "No, General Marshall, you weren't there during the mortar attack," or, "No, General, the enemy was not surrounding us." The thing was that Slam wanted with all his heart to be a real general, but in fact, he was more like the Howard Cosell of combat. He'd never commanded troops either on active duty or in the reserve, but he wanted to command great armies. He wanted to be like the other marshal, George Catlett, for whom he took great delight in being mistaken, and frequently was, which no doubt accounted for more than a little of the blind respect accorded him in that he never bothered to correct an awestruck fan, and his books reflected this. Having wintered with our line forces and green berets in the forward areas, he would manfully encapsulate our tour together in his autobiography and perhaps not even consider the dishonesty of the statement. The truth was, in the air-conditioned five-star dining one-day laundry luxury we lived in, or in the oh-so-secure base camps to the farthest rear of the forward areas where we did many interviews and not once came under fire. The only serious danger we faced was a hangover from one too many martinis in the general's mess. But with Slam, the voyeur warrior, the truth never got in the way of a good story. Slam Marshall was very good to me, until the day came 4 years later when he had to choose between the army, his meal ticket, and me as a soldier and a friend. He went out of his way to be a help to my career. As a civilian, he couldn't give me an ER for our tour together, but he wrote a glowing letter to go into my record about the excellence of our relationship and my contribution to the mission. He was still concerned, however, about the four-month hole in my record, so far as my efficiency reports were concerned, and suggested to General Johnson that he rate me for the lost period. Light colonels do not get rated by the chief of staff of the army, but I did. A highly complimentary report, though like everyone else, Johnson cut me on tact, that secured the future of my army career and virtually guaranteed me a star. When Marshall did stuff like that, I always felt a twinge of conscience that bordered on extreme guilt. There I was, dismissing him as a phony when he was being his most magnanimous. I felt a similar ambivalence when I considered the incredible opportunities being Slam's favored son afforded me, things like sitting down for a drink with Moshe Dayan or Bernard Fall, or such ticket-punching necessities as making myself known among the general officer ranks, for which Slam expected nothing in return. With it all, though, the truth was that Slam was a fallen and irrevocably smashed idol in my eyes. He knew I'd grown away from him throughout our time together, but it was not something to discuss. I cherished my career too much to risk getting on his bad side, and I was opportunistic enough to see the value of staying on the good side. But there must have been many like me whose silence in the face of Slam's power only added to it, and gave credence to his dubious expertise, who allowed him to have an absurd amount of influence, which fed his ego and lined his purse, and for years and years did an incalculable, horrific disservice to the army, the thing he professed to love above all, not to mention to the nation and to the men who fought and died in Vietnam. When General Johnson had warned me, "Take care with Slam, he is the Army's powerful friend, but he can be a treacherous enemy," I had not understood what he meant. But when I finally did, I understood, too, that the Chief of Staff had gotten it backwards. The reality was that Slam Marshall was the Army's powerful enemy because he was its most treacherous friend. And if he were alive today, perhaps even more than the Vietnam-era generals who determinedly maintained we won the war, we lost in their hands, Slam Marshall would have plenty to answer for. Soon I was back to work at the Pentagon, and Slam was home in Birmingham, Michigan, riding LZ Bird, Ambush, West to Cambodia, and the Fields of Bamboo, the four books that ultimately came out of our trip. None proved to be the next Pork Chop Hill Slam had been hoping for to cash in on the film rights. For that matter, none was even particularly well received by the critics or the public. The general did stop by my new Pentagon office. General Johnson had gotten me released from my old job in the bowels of the building and into a new one where I could actually be of some use in the Directorate of Individual Training, to tell me he'd organized half the LZ Bird royalties to come to me. I didn't understand his motive, and so refused the offer. Slam knew how I felt when we'd returned to the first cab to study the bird operation, and that I hadn't done one thing toward the writing of that book. The program we went to Vietnam to teach was high priority until no one was looking anymore. Slam himself didn't give it a second thought. I wrote an article on the technique that appeared in Army Magazine a few months after we got back. But when I returned to Vietnam 23 months later, I didn't see the system being used at all at the bayonet level. For me, the value of the whole experience was digested in the Vietnam primer. While the book did center around what we had seen, in it as well were a lot of hunches I'd developed throughout the journey on how to fight more successfully in Vietnam, perhaps even to win, at least militarily, by beating the little bastards at their own game. And while it would be a long wait until I had the opportunity to try those hunches out, at least despite what Slam so obstinately had to say, it wasn't as if the war was going away. 17. Corporate Headquarters. I expected the military crowd to be different. I was looking for the square-shouldered majors and colonels with the bright can-do attitude about their job of defending the United States of America. While I saw a few people like that, I was shocked to realize that many of the military men in the building were just bureaucrats in uniform. I later learned that a dedicated military man dreads assignment to the Pentagon, but I also learned the bureaucratic military men made their best career advancements there. Dina Razor, Director, Project on Military Procurement. Pentagon duty was not for the nervous or the faint-hearted. The pressure was enormous. You had to look good and perform well under working conditions that would make an industrial psychologist reel back in horror. The Directorate of Individual Training, DIT, where I worked, was especially taxing. With more than 400,000 people in Vietnam at that time, and the numbers set to expand another 100,000, even as rotation and casualties were constantly removing personnel from the theater, the stateside training base was struggling to keep up. Current training facilities were in a constant state of expansion. New courses were being developed to meet the heavy training demands of the battlefield, and their genesees were almost all on or in the immediate vicinity of my desk. My office, a claustrophobic hole no larger than 20 by 20 windowless feet, housed 15 people, three clattering typewriters, and some dozen or two constantly ringing telephones. The Pentagon was laid out as five concentric circles labeled from the inside out, A to E. As such, only the E ring, which contained such offices as those of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their staffs, had windows that looked out on the real world. A typical day there found your inbox spilling over with a foot or two of papers when you arrived at work in the quiet of the morning, but you hardly had a chance to read even the first sentence of the first one, much less try to write anything, before your phones started ringing. Before long, you found yourself juggling four phone calls in four time zones from four agencies with four problems. Add to that the fact that your office mates were simultaneously juggling their phone calls, their voices raised in the struggle to be heard above the din of which you were all very much a part, and you suddenly had one very uptight organization. Warriors with even two stars under their belts were not seasoned vets to this sort of combat. If Sherman said war is hell, it was only because the Pentagon hadn't been built yet. My first job at DIT was that of Chief of the Individual Training Branch. After a few months, I moved over to DIT's Schools and Education Division, SEDIT, as Chief of the Schools Branch, where I was responsible on the policy level for the operation and functioning of all U.S. Army service schools in the United States. In the second job, I also served as one of the 5 action officers in my branch, with my specific areas of concern being the infantry, airborne, jungle, counterinsurgency, military police, and ranger schools. With training, my longtime passion, if I had to be in the Pentagon, it was probably the best job I could have had, provided that a way could be found to blast through the concrete that locked obsolete Army doctrine in place. For the first time in my career, I was actually in a position to do something about it. Among the first things I learned at DIT was that U.S. Army doctrine was not created by the generals. Major and Lieutenant Colonel action officers like myself spread throughout DA's general staff, another vital punch on the old ticket, could and did start the ball rolling in all areas of policy change. Whoever sat in a particular action officer's chair was considered the expert in his field. He did the hard legwork and wrote recommendations that often rivaled the thickness of a Sunday New York Times. All the 3-star generals had to do was make the decisions, which were usually based on 1-page summaries attached to the action officer's recommendations. But I quickly learned that changes in policy were in no way expedited by this procedure. In fact, this system was just the tip of the bureaucratic iceberg. The expert action officer who initiated a recommendation had to coordinate it with other expert action officers and their bosses in other directorates affected by it throughout the Pentagon. Be it in intelligence, operations, logistics, doctrine, or whatever, each agency had to give the project or study a chop or concurrence before it could go to the assistant chiefs of staff or the chief himself for the final judgment. Just one problem with this was that almost everyone along the line felt compelled to put his 2 cents in, even when he had nothing to offer. Virtually everyone rewrote your work. Usually it wasn't even a question of content, it was a question of style. And when you were on a short fuse to get the thing upstairs, as was generally the case, it could really start to get to you. There were many majors and lieutenant colonel clerks who thrived in this atmosphere, where the means were ends in themselves and only trivia was all important. But putting a warrior in the Pentagon was kind of like telling a street fighter to put down his dukes and take up hairdressing. And a Pentagon assignment was a strange reward for a leader fresh off the battlefield. One day a commander of 1,000 men, the next day a lackey in a crowded bureaucracy, working in little better than sweatshop conditions. I'd hated the place when I was there after my tour with the first of the 101, and I hated it when I came back after my trip with SLAM. And among the only people who hated it more was my set-it boss and old first of the 101 rival, Hank Emerson, who'd arranged my transfer to his school's division in the first place. Both of us knew we had to put in our time, but it didn't stop us from actively looking for a way to escape with honor. Emerson had been trying to get out from his first day, but was consistently blocked by the DIT director and our boss, Major General Melvin Zeiss, who told him he had enough awards and decorations and now needed some sophistication if he hoped to advance further in the Army. For myself, even as I plotted how I'd get a master's degree to kill 2 birds with 1 stone, one more vital punch on the ticket, and an out from corporate headquarters, I knew I had a lot to be thankful for. Hank Emerson was a warrior and a war buddy, and we were like-minded in many ways, not least of which being our mutual drive to be totally professional in our trade. So I could bitch and scream and carry on, which at the Pentagon was easy to want to do, and even if Hank didn't agree 100%, at least he understood how I felt. Imagine how it would have been had I found myself working for a Pentagon hero who loved being there. At the time when I switched over to SETIT in mid-1967, the Army schools system was in total disarray. Although the war was in fact going very badly, the basic optimism about it that permeated the Pentagon at this time made fundamental changes in training policy close to impossible to achieve. Even if there had not been the layer after layer of virtually immovable bureaucratic rock to blast through, from DA to CONARC to the individual service schools at Benning, Bragg, Knox, Sill, and Bliss, to name just a few, there was a basic problem of philosophy at the highest levels. 2 years into the jungle-oriented war in Vietnam, all our schools were still geared up for Two up, one back, high diddle diddle, right down the middle, confrontations on European battlefields. The infantry school was still teaching to close with the enemy, which was the worst thing you could do in Vietnam. Meanwhile, our guerrilla non-conventional enemy was making hay while the sun shone on our conventional yesterday's war approach to the conflict. Though everyone agreed that something had to be done, the general feeling was that Vietnam was a hiccup. We would not scuttle our basic mission, that is, preparation for war in Europe or Korea, for an aberration soon to pass. This attitude persisted despite the fact that as the Vietnam War continued, our forces in Korea and Europe were reduced to third and fourth string status, with second lieutenants commanding companies and PFCs running squads as the more seasoned combat-ready personnel were drawn down from 7th and 8th Army resources to fill urgently needed battlefield requirements in Vietnam. This situation alone should have proved to those in charge that the Russians had no intention of making war on Europe at that time, if they didn't attack when we were so obviously vulnerable. But whatever the philosophy that ruled the school's system and dictated the general direction of the instruction, with almost 500,000 U.S. troops rotating through Vietnam, the fact remained that the war machine had to be fed. And in that the school's system was responsible for preparing the bodies, an overriding philosophy developed within the system that could be summed up in one word. Output. High attrition rates in the schools became totally unacceptable. In the effort to produce, little thought was given to the product itself. How many graduated, rather than how well or appropriately trained they were, became the vital statistic. More fodder for the cannon, and never mind that the gun was pointed in the wrong direction. In January of 1967, when Dennis Foley, my 101st Tiger Force leader and himself a 1964 OCS graduate, returned to Benning as a captain and an instructor, the first officer assigned to the company operations department with Vietnam U.S. troop experience, he found that the normal two or three OCS classes a year had blossomed into dozens of classes run concurrently. Between fiscal year 1966 and 67, OCS officer production at six branch schools, Benning, Belvoir, Sill, McClellan, Gordon, and Knox, jumped from 3,881 to 18,334 men and WACs. He also found that the almost 50% attrition rate that attended classes in the peacetime years had dropped to, at max, 5%. The running joke at Benning, he told me, was, the standards of OCS haven't been lowered, it's just that the students aren't required to meet them anymore. Colonel Floyd Gibb Gibson, my counterpart over at Konark, was actually sent to the infantry school to investigate whenever a class showed an excessive attrition rate. And when Gibb, a warrior from the old school, suggested that one of the purposes of OCS was to weed out undesirables, rather than recycling them to follow-on classes until they passed or the instructor gave up, he was told by his superior he harbored a negative attitude. Of course, Gibb had a knack for rubbing clerks the wrong way. 3 years earlier, he had volunteered to serve as a province senior advisor in Vietnam, and with 4 years' experience learning about the Oriental mind as a MAG advisor to the Nationalist Chinese Army, he was the perfect choice. But the war had begun in earnest for the U.S. by the time Gibb got to Vietnam, and his advisory abilities notwithstanding, as a veteran of two wars with the command of two platoons, nine companies, and a battalion under his belt, Gibb was an equally fine choice for a combat assignment. He got neither. Instead, he was banished to a desk job in the J3 shop of the Rural Reconstruction Division at MACV's Saigon headquarters. Gibb couldn't believe it, and began a somewhat vociferous campaign to get a job where he could actually be of use to the war effort. But all that earned him was a haughtily plunged knife in the back by a clerk raider in his next ER. Lieutenant Colonel Gibson has strong emotional feelings and frequently expressed his opinion that a soldier's duty is to fight. This attitude limits his value to the service, his desire for self-improvement, and adversely affects his subordinates. The school's system was also plagued by a severe shortfall of instructors. More and more were being authorized by DA to each school to cope with the never-expanding requirement for new courses and additional classes, but fewer and fewer were actually being assigned. The numbers simply were not available. It was the blind leading the blind all over again. Just as I'd found fresh back from Korea in early 1952, many of the instructors were pink-cheeked lieutenants who never heard a shot fired in anger, who, in fact, had only just finished their own training, but had been considered studs enough by their instructors to be given places on the faculty. In this atmosphere, it was little wonder that hands-on training out in the boonies with pros teaching their tricks was replaced with handy-dandy training films and dull classroom lectures. No one, myself included, stopped to say enough. It was much simpler to juggle class sizes or add an extra Vietnam-oriented lesson to an existing curriculum. The gung-ho, can-do, zero-defect Army spirit did not understand the word impossible. And in our branch, we were run so ragged just setting up the mechanisms to make particular training available, every detail having to be cleared by half the Pentagon along the way, that there was rarely time to consider what we were even doing. How truly inefficient our system was only became clear to me when the requirement arose for me to liaise with the Navy to establish a particular block of training. The proposed course was for replacement commanders and staff officers bound for the Riverine Force, a U.S. Army brigade tasked with conducting amphibious operations from U.S. Navy ships in the Mekong Delta. Only God and General Westmoreland knew why this Delta mission hadn't been assigned to the Marines, who were qualified for that sort of thing as a matter of course, but mine was not to reason why, and I called my counterpart in the Navy Department about how to